Good evening. It's a Wednesday night. It's 7 o'clock here on the West Coast. And we're in the 16th or 15th, what week
are
we
on? We are on
16th week of traveling our way through the book called Work of Groups, which is in the Secret Talk series that hasn't been made public in a sense. But if you'd like a copy, and you're intrigued by some of the material that is revealed here, then let us know and we'll get you a copy somehow. Okay, I can't remember. Did you ever get it up on the Gateway site, Evan?
Good question.
I don't think it is, actually. I think it's a special request.
Yeah.
You have to make a special request, and we're the ones to fulfill those special requests.
That's right.
So, where we're going to do tonight, we're going to focus on one chapter that's about 5 paragraphs long, but I felt it was a core concept for virtually everything we do in our spiritual work, and I think it's worth it to take the time to unplug it just a little bit. Okay? Dan, are you ready to go over there? Okay, thank you. So, we're going to focus on chapter 36 page 80. I think it's on page 86. But before we do that, one of the purposes of this group, none of us are skilled enough to say what the purpose of the group is, okay? I guarantee you that is the truth, because we probably won't know for another year, if then at all. But what we do in this group is we are reading a Secret Talks volume called Work of Groups, and as a combined group, we're notating things that we are saying, this is an element of a group, okay? And so we do that, and we're collecting those. At some point in the distant future, I'm going to put them up on the website so you can begin just viewing the raw data.
Mm-hmm.
And since we properly put, look how well put together this space is, by the way.
It's
and I don't
beautiful.
Mean... I don't just mean the physical. By the space, I mean we have presenters, we have a scribe,
mm-hmm.
we have a doorkeep, really, that's
mm-hmm.
part of your job,
mm-hmm.
and then we have a kind of a fire tender, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, making sure that it's still cooking.
So what are the elements of any space, and sometimes having the elements creates the space.
It can.
In a good space, then you've reflected those elements that are needed to fulfill the space at that time. So we have that. So one of the things that we're going to do then is just read from chat week 15, did we make any notations? We already read that. Okay. So,
Catherine,
go ahead and read those off for us. Then,
this was Wednesday, 6/28/17, Work of Groups, Week 15. 1. Operations of a Group. 1. The first real task of a group is to make exact aims, both as individual candidates for the work and also as a group. That is a quote referencing page 82. Number 2, the value of a group. Each brings a bit, the whole picture. So by being a group, we contribute to one another as multiple guides in pursuit of a single aim, i.e. the awakening of the essential self, make it active, the center of gravity, and make the machine passive. I'll read that to you again.
Okay.
The value of a group. Each brings a bit of the whole picture. So by being a group, we contribute to one another as multiple guides in pursuit of a single aim, i.e., the awakening of the essential self. Make it active, the center of gravity, and make the machine passive. Number three, if the group is cohesive, the group energy itself provides a form of guidance. It gives a bar of excellence to match.
Like in raise
you
the
have,
bar.
Raise the bar. Oh,
like
yes.
Raise the bar.
It gives a bar of excellence to match. Okay,
yeah.
Great. Number four, in a group, you not only can decide on methodologies to achieve a common aim, but can also, in the group space, experience guidance through the group interface via members sharing questions,
mm-hmm.
reflections, and experiences.
Right.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go back and watch last week's
okay.
archive.
So, where we are then, so as we go through, we're going to make various points, and then our scribe culls those out and says, here are the elements that we consider a group that we discovered this week.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? We'll do that. What I want to do now, though, is I want to get into this chapter 36, if we're ready to go. Okay? And so we're going to go ahead and begin it. It's short enough. I'm actually not even that interested in the last paragraph or the second to the last, you know.
Yeah. That's narrative.
That's a different narrative, but let's go ahead at least and read those first few paragraphs, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Would either one of you like to work?
You want to start? Okay. Chapter 36, Necessity. G asks whether there can be motivation without necessity. The group agreed that there cannot be. He then asked if there can be necessity without motivation. Some of us said no, and G launched into an explanation of the difference between subjective and objective necessity.
One who has subjective necessity, who has desire for something, but no real need for it organically or in a higher way, can motivate without necessity. This is subjective necessity. But one could have objective necessity, but not motivate in the lower centers, as for example, someone who ought to be in the work, is ripe for the work, but may not be interested in or know about the ideas.
Let me read that to you again, okay? An important paragraph. One who has subjective necessity, who has desire for something but no real need for it organically or in a higher way, can motivate without necessity. This is subjective necessity, but one could have objective necessity but not motivate in the lower centers. As for example, someone who ought to be in the work, is ripe for the work, but may not be interested or know about the ideas. Sure is, huh? Go ahead.
Subjective need could be called motivation, and objective need, necessity. Increase of necessity, G said, is most basic source of force for work.
G discussed the difference between subjective and objective slavery. To be a slave to the work is not good if it is involuntary slavery from desire, considering, habit, or inherited beliefs. Voluntary subjective slavery is, on the other hand, a real basis for work. For voluntary slave, we could say idiot.
That's when I first learned that phrase from Ivan, actually, early on when I first came. He goes, well, who's the idiot that's, you know, in charge of this right now? Who's the idiot that's the driver or the whatever it is, the choreographer? And you got a sense that you could be in that position, and it is a voluntary role to subject yourself to the necessity of that position. Let me give you an example here. We in the room here, there's roughly 6 people, okay?
Well, some are smooth and some are ripply, so we said rough, okay. Roughly.
Let's say that I suggested that your job, Paula, was to monitor the door. Nothing has happened since, mm-hmm. You know, and in many cases, in most classes, there may be 2 people that come in. Jewel will come in and do something at her desk and leave. Mm-hmm. Christiane will come in, maybe take a shot. And then sometimes Michelle comes in and joins us, right? That's the only action. But if I say, your job is to do that now, mm-hmm. Doesn't that change your mentation of the space? You're like more engaged in it, right?
Well, it identifies something maybe you weren't even aware of, first of all.
First of all.
It highlights something, brings it more into focus. And then secondly, you actually can see yourself as having, thank you. Perfect timing. We're talking about someone who has the job of monitoring the door. And in walks our first ex-visitor. Member tonight. So yeah, when you could possibly see yourself in a role, then you pay more attention to it. So first it gets pointed out to you, hey, there's something there. It's called a monitor, door monitor. And then you go, oh, that's actually a something. Well, what does it mean to be a something? So and then you consider, well, maybe I could do that. Maybe, you know, I could possibly.
It's we like, have, Dan, how long have you been coming to the Wednesday night class? 4 years. What has your role been most of the time, if not all the time? Go ahead.
Basically monitoring the computer and the chat.
Monitoring the computer and the chat. For some reason, about a month ago, that became a post. Okay? You've been doing it forever, mm-hmm. But you have a sense of what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. I remember exactly when it happened.
And you remember when it happened, and you remember when I pointed it out. And since then, you've objectively been different.
Now, that may not be very obvious for you, but there are qualifications for fulfilling a post, and they're not all the same, but in one regard they are exactly all the same, and that is It has to be at least deliberate, if not conscious. It cannot be a sleeping post. You cannot fill your post if you're asleep.
Impossible.
Can't be done.
And in some spaces, as the space increases in necessity, those who are not engaged just literally
fall asleep.
They physically fall asleep,
yeah.
Which means they're not in that space.
That's correct, totally.
And we've seen that as a kind of a measure. It's an objective measure,
yeah,
in a sense, to who should be there and who shouldn't be there. So that's like advanced necessity in a way, where we're talking about now fulfilling a post.
Yeah, you know, I'd like to say, David, the perspective you're bringing to it is interesting, because what I see in the passage we just read,
yep,
it ends with, for voluntary slave, we could say idiot, which is to say, if there's a change, in other words, you're identifying, well, there's a moment of change. Well, I mean, you know, being assigned and told, okay, please do this, okay, I'll do this, and so on, is not necessarily taking on the post, but this is identifying the voluntary part is, okay, I will do this job. Now you're the idiot because you've put your machine, in the sense you're directing your machine.
But
yeah.
Well, I don't know.
Okay.
And that's what got me confused about this chapter. Because talking about being a voluntary slave to the necessity of the work at that moment, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Spinoza calls that, he says, you become a spiritual automaton 350 years ago.
Okay.
You call it this fourth state of viewing. If you're in that, then you become a spiritual. If you're operating in regards to the necessities of your own nature. Now, this is a rare thing, and this is the core of what I wanted to get into tonight. Now, EJ, the students that were there, there's actually no quotes from EJ in this first part, if I remember correctly. They're just declaring what he said, and then...
There is one.
But then he says, what's the fundamental topic? EJ talked about the difference between what and what?
Motivation.
So there's motivation, but it's also between subjective necessity and
mm-hmm.
objective necessity. So he gave a talk on that.
Right, and it's not in there.
The talk isn't here. So these students who are there, they're just reflecting something back to us.
Mm-hmm.
Saying, this thing occurred, and here's the core concept of it. So they're just placing it at our feet, and they're saying, what do you think? So do we understand the idea of subjective necessity? Let's clarify that. Todd, go ahead and... You have a sense of that.
Well, I think this is a totally eye-opening talk. I mean, it's so short, but I mean, look, yeah. What I'd like to say is, look what he says here about the way he defines it is he's saying one who has subjective necessity. The second paragraph. It's one who has a subjective necessity is one who has desire for something, but no real need for it organically or in a higher way. But then he finishes the sentence, but that's the definition.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I find what's stunning about that, if you would have just asked me before reading this, what is subjective necessity, I would have said, like, well, you know, if I'm hungry, you know, then I go to the kitchen, I'm driven to the refrigerator or something like that. But that's what he's saying here, there's no real need for it organically. So, I mean... What I think what he's describing here as subjective necessity is something on the order of fantasy. It's what's not real. It's what's actually illusion. I think what in Buddhism you would say, all phenomena is illusion. It's and the fact is, boy, I can tell you right now, there's plenty of times when I'm driven to the refrigerator. I'm actually not hungry, but I find myself at the refrigerator because it's some other subjective, you know, subjective motivation. Is it, you know, subjective necessity?
Well, he's about motivation.
Well, yeah, I was saying I'm motivated. I'm motivated to go to the refrigerator, but I'm not actually hungry, you know. So I think there's tons of stuff in our mechanical, you know, in our everyday lives, in our, what would you call it, in our personality or character lives, is like that.
In an email, I just said, it is things like you get hungry, your car's running out of gas. Look what happens when you're almost out of gas in your car, for those of you that drive. What happens? Like, you're just immediately hunting, right, for a gas station.
Mm-hmm.
Your attention just goes, wham, where's the gas station? And if you see one, if one shows up, you see it. You actually notice it. So my point is that when there are, the machine has certain things imaginary for the most part, and it just says, I need this.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no higher purpose involved. It's not, you're not at the throne of the essential self at this point. You're just doing your thing. Okay? Then he talks, then I wrote in the email a little story I'd heard many, many, many years ago from, this is when I was in the Sat Nam group. You know, you just sit in Darshan with the, many, many years ago. And the story was, so this young aspirant goes to the guru who's sitting by the river, and he says, I'd like to be your student. So the guru has no response to this guy, none. Guy goes away, comes back the next day, and says, I'd like to be your student. No response, nothing, never turns his head, doesn't breathe differently, nothing. The third day, the guy comes back, the guru stands up, and he asks the same question, the guru stands up, pulls him into the river, and pushes his head under the water, and he holds him there. The guy is fighting for his life. Just before he's about to drown, the guru lifts him up, and he goes, when you want the truth as much as you want it air, then you'll be ready. So that's an illustration of necessity, right?
Objective necessity.
Well, if we're going to be seen at the time, I sometimes have a strange trouble with my throat, and I start to feel like, what do you call it? It goes down the wrong pipe, and I start to choke. I've had this a number of times, many times. So I start to choke like I'm going to die. And you get into a funny space. This is just by accident, this happened. And you get into this strange little space, and suddenly you realize, this may be it.
Mm-hmm.
This may be it. But then the body says, no way, and you go, pah, pops it up. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I was there to go another day. Go ahead, Dan.
I just noticed this phrasing here. One who has subjective necessity, who has desire for something, but no real need for it organically. So objective necessity can be organic or it can be in a higher way. It just can't be mental.
It can't be mental.
Only mental.
Only mental. And it's this other necessity, this objective necessity that I wanted us to get to, okay? What is, not only what is it, but when you read this story about this guy, right, seeking this guru, doesn't that kind of ring true to you a little bit? You go, yeah, that what the guy said is right. And I should have that kind of necessity, right? The passion. What did these, can you tell me what motivated somebody like Dostoevsky in the miserable situation he was in to write not one or two, but several classics in Western literature? He was by himself in this dusty old cold room. What a horrible life. And he was just writing away. Gosh, I wish I had passion like that. Gosh.
That's necessity, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if that's...
Even to the level of being compelled to fulfill whatever that is, like the terrific Michael Nijinsky, when he was performing, he had to perform, in a sense, to fulfill something in him. So I can see that, or like a great swimmer or baseball player.
Hold on, David. Are you characterizing those as objective, those drives, those necessities?
I'm just characterizing them as passions that are there. They're, that's a spark of energy. What is the thing that he said that increase of necessity is the most basic source of force for work? So sometimes, I guess what I'm saying is I can feel that fabric of necessity within me. It's like, why am I keep coming here? Night after, this Dan has been here for 4 years. We've been here for 10 or 8 or some darn thing, right?
Yeah, 9 years.
So it just continues. There's something, but I don't. It's not quite this passion that Dostoevsky had at his writing table. Look at Van Gogh, this idiot. He sold one piece in his lifetime to his brother. One of the greatest artists, of course, in all of Western, in the entire world, actually, forget it. So, if we can sense, can you sense at least the bubbling of that necessity within you that's compelling you in a certain way? I'm not saying it should be at the passion of the guy's head under the water or these artists or, I don't know, other people who are in it and compelled, and their life takes shape because of that motivation. Motivation is actually kind of a strange word, isn't it? Pat, you know, when I met Pat 30, 25 years ago, she was part of one of the important reasons I think I moved here was because of her love for the ABD and the whole, what's now called the Labyrinth Reader Society. And that was compelling to me. I was drawn to it. Okay? So there was something in her necessity, her, whatever it is, how it works in her, I don't know. But I can see something. It reminds me of a deeper necessity in me. Maybe that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
How do you like that?
I'm looking at something where I have hesitation about my use of these words, necessity and motivation and subjective and objective. Because the examples that are familiar to us, of especially artists, and the passion that is manifest, and the drive that you know has to have been there in order for that to manifest as it did, especially in creative arts, that isn't something at all like how I, even a little bit, sense what I think you're talking about. And so I was just investigating in myself when you were speaking of it. And, you know, we know in a certain way how we got to the teaching, or we have some idea at least of the life pathways that brought us there, not necessarily, you know, everything about it. But that, and I'm going to use the word sensing because I don't have a better word at the moment, or
great
tasting.
One. Great.
That is not operant in my normal daily motivations or activities very much. So it doesn't like run my life. So it's not the same for me as singing. I think I live better by singing. I live better by singing music and breathing in that way. But I also, the body and the machine came with a voice. So singing is part of what this whole package is. So I know for a fact that is not necessarily an objective quality. Just for right now,
yeah.
I'm just posing that. So I'm looking at that, and then I look at what you're talking about, which is if other things are gone, like interactions or job fulfillment, career fulfillment, whatever those other things are in your life, and that isn't enough, what is left, that's how I'm viewing it at the moment, just posing it, what is left is what I would say is that other kind of sensing thing. And if I link up the moments of my life of that being the operating principle, then it doesn't feel to me like motivation. It feels to me more like recovery or recognition. You know, it's more like it just comes and you go,
this is
oh,
the
right.
fundamental
yeah,
of where I wanted
it.
To get, because
that's where it is.
My question is, like when I hear this, I think of this story of this guy with his head under the water, I know what that means. I know what this guru is saying to the guy. I know exactly what it feels like. Why can't I recognize it more directly with both hands? And where is it that it says lightning handlers always crackle?
Life in the labyrinth.
Life in the labyrinth. That's what I'm talking about. I can feel it inches away. I can feel it inches away, and it's like I'm looking over a wall at it to recognize it, Pat. I like the way you put that thing.
You're looking over a wall.
It's like I'm looking, it's over there.
See, it's so much a, what did the configuration of conditioning and language and education and blah, blah, blah stuff do with these words for me right now, which is when I was 9 and my twin cousins were visiting and I'm throwing the, you know, ball up against the wall and I'm saying to them, well, the only really important thing about living is to find out about dying. And they go, are you dying? What's wrong? Cousin, are you okay? Have you prayed lately? You know, it's like, no. That's not what I mean. And I mean, for me, that was totally the real stuff. So I didn't have a context of the story. Where, for you, that story, it speaks it. You...
It's a good example of what I'm trying to talk about.
And I don't get that from those words or those images.
Aren't you talking about necessity? Wouldn't you call this necessity?
Well,
see, what I'm thinking, let me just say something. Let me just try something, David. Well, no, I want to go back to what Patricia is using as an example. So when you are singing, when you are singing, do you need to be motivated?
No.
No, I'm thinking that when you're singing, that's all about necessity. You're tapping necessity. And he's talking about Van Gogh and Dostoevsky and so on.
Yep.
And I'm being a writer, I mean, I can relate to some of that. But what I'm saying is, so there are these moments, and again, I'm thinking of the pearls, you know, EJ talking about the essence moments, you know, the pearls of awakening that you string together. The more and more you have them in your everyday life, then the closer you get to in essence life. Well, in essence life, or at least, let's say, having a necklace that doesn't go away, maybe, or something. But what I'm thinking is, see, when you're not singing, how about when you're not singing, like, where is your necessity or your motivation when you're not in the moment, when you're not doing something that's so present or so essential that you know
that you should be there, or that you don't need to be anywhere else.
Well, it's not a bad question. And Pat's probably inches away in a certain way from having an alternate life that would have been devoted to singing. I mean, then you are fulfilled.
Yeah. Do you ever recall EJ having like 25 people around the table and going around and saying, oh yeah, here's what we have here. Oh, we have a scientist here who doesn't do science. And here we have an artist who does not painting. And we have over here a writer who's, putting stamps on letters. And we have this, and to me, it was, this is throwing light on that kind of, summary, I don't know, what would you call it, observation about a group, a working group, because it's like saying, well, geez, those subjective motivations, you know, those things, those are not necessity. You all are sitting here in a circle. We're here in this group because we have a necessity, and that necessity is not necessarily have to do with what makes us happy or what's going to make a life of ease or affluence or anything like that. You know, yeah.
And true recognition of the objective. So we can get caught into the subjective necessity of busyness.
Right.
Everybody is busy.
Let me just use the next half of this sentence, which is...
Go ahead.
It's the top of page 87. The paragraph starts with subjective need... could be called motivation, and objective need, necessity. Okay.
Good.
It could be. But the next quote, and the other one was not a quote, this is a quote, increase of necessity, which to me implies...
Keep going.
...a certain capacity to be responsive to increase, G said, is most basic source of force for work. So, when EJ says, here is an opportunity, not in so many words, an opportunity for you to pick up obligation or to pick up necessity, not for self, not even for recognition for self. That's the point I was getting to. Because it may be that you don't get it for yourself, but you do the thing anyway. It may not matter that you personally grasp what is being offered, but you're willing to be the medium by where it gets brought forth. To me, this sentence, increase of necessity is most basic source of force for work, that implies something that is, it's a challenge, and it's also, there's another word that comes when you get something that makes it make sense. We'll come up with the word later. Anyway, that you could have necessity, which of its own accord would not take you far in the work. But if you were able to increase the necessity or allow yourself to have increased necessity, which means you get used, you know what I mean? You get made available. And that provides this flow. Anyway. I could wander down
the first,
a long way.
But the first phrase is the most revelatory, where it says increase.
Yes.
Which means maybe it is possible to increase.
Exactly.
So if it's so possible, I'm wondering, how do I increase my necessity? Why am I blocked from it? See, why am I blocked from it? And this is the core of what came out of this for me, is that I think this is an infinite source of power and energy and focus. And I can kind of...
I think you're really getting... Oops.
I think you're really getting down to it now. You're getting down to something nitty-gritty. I mean, are you saying, I was trying to get to this before, I think. Are you saying that the necessity is over there somewhere?
Go ahead.
Well, Eric Brummel says, take that instant of wanting breath and disperse it over a lifetime, the passion of just hanging in there. And then he asks, is necessity an indication of having objective conscience?
It's the beginning of it. Yeah, Eric, it's the beginning of it. It's, so I have this sense of what my necessity is, and it's different than Pat's.
Mm-hmm.
See, for me, for some reason, I've been in touch with her since the day I got here. We were, you know, very close. And I could see it in her. And I comment not about it, but the mind is different than that one, but harmonious. We're obviously harmonious
mm-hmm.
with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So if this formula says more power, there's more energy, there's more force, if you increase your necessity.
Mm.
Now, that's implying that one way to do it is to put yourself under obligation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Like, I'm volunteering to watch the door tonight.
Mm-hmm.
That, which will now be a thing.
Well, Doc Off says, I thought you create more necessity by taking on more obligation. So.
Thank you.
So,
that's what David is just getting to. Okay.
He's just reporting what's on the chat.
But I'm saying that's what
David was just getting to.
What I wanted to ask is, previously we spoke about borrowing will. Can't you also borrow necessity?
Yes.
You can. And
absolutely.
You can, and we all have. I mean, part of the reason that we've stayed here is because we're able to borrow the necessity that EJ has for the fulfillment of his work.
I think when we get to the very next talk, it says something quite opposite to that. But let's not get there. Let's not do that tonight. I just wanted to say that, you know, I'm still not sure if I'm grokking like the way that you're feeling this or sensing this, because, okay, I'm getting. Who was talking about? You were talking about your childhood and with your cousins or something like that. Okay,
yeah.
It makes me think of that. There's, let's see. According to this, I mean, I could be. It seems to me, if I were a writer like Dostoevsky, which I don't think I am, but if I were as driven as a writer, let's say, as Dostoevsky or William Faulkner, I could come up with some more. Doris Lessing, I don't know. To me, that would be subjective motivation, because there's a list here that EJ is saying in the next paragraph, to be a slave to the work is not good if it is involuntary, involuntary slavery. And he says, here's what is involuntary slavery? From desire, considering, habit, or inherited beliefs.
But I believe the people were talking, they were not operating.
Okay, well, I can accept that.
Voluntarily, they said, I am now a slave to this. This is all I can do. This is what I'm meant to do with my life.
Okay, but is it possible that's involuntary slavery, no matter how great they are at what they're doing?
I don't know.
Okay, well, here's what I want.
The only answer is we ask the God.
Yeah. Here's what I wanted to say, David, is that there's, I don't know if anybody else can relate to this, but what I associate for myself with this necessity that has force, you know, that I can increase, that I can build on, or that has driven me in a sense that's I don't have a rationale for it. This is my main idea about it, is that there is no rationale. I always had this problem with my father, not so much my mother, it was both my parents, but especially my father, like, okay, you're doing what? You've got this degree, and now you've got this other degree, and so, and now you're doing what? Or you're going to an organization that's working with childbirth and doing something about death and dying, and you're helping them with publishing, and you're, well, why aren't you, what happened to this over here that you got your degrees for, and this and that. And what I'm saying is this whole formulation here is causing me to recall that in a sense there was some drive or some sensations that I had as a child which were very undescribable. They were uncontainable. They were undescribable. They didn't actually motivate me towards anything. I mean, towards anything that was in my life at the time. I simply didn't know what to do with what those messages were, what those things. But I believe that became, to a greater and greater degree when I got older, this kind of necessity that he's talking about, because I ended up on the doorstep of a school. Okay, and so in a sense, the necessity, I think that, from my point of view, the necessity that he's talking about here is a force in your life that just throws a spanner in the work, that smashes all kinds of other ordinary, happy-go-lucky or whatever, mechanical, like, ordinary life outcomes, like, well, why don't you, and, you know, it is just like, you know, as much as it sounds like a soap opera, you know, my father used to say, well, don't you want a good government job with a pension, you know, and benefits? Who are you working for? Okay, do they have benefits? You know, yeah. That was the discussion I had with my father.
But that's his subjective view of the world. What I'm saying is that in each of us rests, and it's different for each of us, it rests this, like this, in the Japanese roshis would call it, like, the hot iron ball that sits in you, and you know that has to be addressed. And for me, this is a very hopeful chapter because it says, you can increase this. You can get closer to the fire. And I start to wonder then, why do I not do that?
Well, I think optimally, the discussion is not about how you can or can't do that. Because I think what this is saying, I just reread the paragraph before, bottom of 86, paragraph 2. It says, but one could have objective necessity, but not motivate in the lower centers. As, for example, someone who ought to be in the work is ripe for the work, but may not be interested in or know about the idea.
And we've had that.
And I think there is this aspect to being willing to take on obligation, yes, being willing to be a voluntary slave, yes, but not necessarily knowledgeable or familiar with the what they're called the work ideas, which I have other ways of thinking about it these days, but because there's this capacity to allow oneself to have more of, that's the tricky part,
yes,
more of necessity. Now, here's my last example for the evening, because it'll be gruesome. So for those women in the room who have had the childbirth experience, just allow me to be graphically explicit here for the education of the males and those females who have not had that experience. If delivery is imminent and you have not in your form, either because of practice or breathing or custom or whatever the circumstances are, maybe the shape of your pelvis is wrong. Who knows? But if you don't have a way to open up to the point of bursting asunder your universe for the moment, That head's not coming through, and you're going to be in a mess of trouble, and so is the babe. So what happens? Somebody says to you, hey, the babe's almost ready to come out now. Just give it one more big push. And you know that it's probably going to split you in two, but your babe's going to live. Wow, you go for it. That's increased necessity.
Correct.
Of the most
correct.
Organic kind. However, there's components there. You have to have some knowledge of what it is. You have to have some physical capacity. You need to be in the space where you're willing to do that. These days, of course, they can just take you to the hospital, gas you up, and, you know, drag the babe out. That's not so nice. But you see what I'm saying? It's not just because the opportunity is there. That's not enough. There's more something needed, and this is what I'm thinking relates to what you're talking about.
I think that, what's the story about the guy that he can't, you know, climb the wall or something, so he throws his hat over the wall, and he has to go get it?
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
He creates necessity.
Yep.
That's
a way of creating necessity.
So I think that, I'll just say a couple of things, okay,
yes,
in summary.
Yes,
all right, because
thank you.
I think that I'm blocked from my core necessity
mm-hmm.
because I think it's too hot to handle. I think that I don't want it to change my life. My human life is comfortable, it's set, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's hard, I work hard, but to stand in the place of Dostoevsky, I don't know that I want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So my machine comes forth, with, in my opinion, with great force and blocks me from it.
Mm-hmm.
It lets me see it over the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Right, okay. Yeah.
I think I'm starting to get it now, David.
I'm separated from this alchemical fire that's within me. And certain things that I do bring it right to the forefront.
You know, this maybe the conversation we're having may have a lot to do with typicalities, with character types or something, because, see, you're reminding me that there have been times in my life when I've been hysterically frightened, I mean, absolutely
yeah.
terrified,
yeah.
And terrified at, you know, this is not at some
physical
monster. Yeah, this is not at some actually, you know, fantasy or at some or either at some truck
no,
bearing down on me
no
or something.
There's no nice.
No,
no. Person
yeah. Well, I'm saying I don't think I've ever been like physically. I mean, like actually in life circumstances,
yeah.
accosted by anything
yeah.
that's terrified me as much as moments of confronting. Like what this necessity is that I am unable to resist the force of this necessity and what it actually how much it actually weighs how much power it packs you know that I think that I have felt. I have felt the smallness of myself in relation to something very, very large, and by typicality, I mean I've been terrified. I've been absolutely fearful, mortified by it,
mm-hmm.
and it's not easy for me to escape from that. You know, that's
mm-hmm.
that emotional reflex is hard to escape.
I don't know if anybody else can relate to this.
Correct me if I'm wrong about this, but it seems to me that necessity is a void or a lack. There's a need for something.
Yeah.
And part of the reason that we don't experience necessity is because it's uncomfortable. We don't want to feel that lack or void.
I think you're soft selling it a little bit there, because I think that it's by its definition, it's saying, I am going to pull you into the void. I'll never forget Lee Loswick standing in Sacramento down there.
Yeah.
And he said, you get into a space, and you're in the space, and they said, do you want to do this? And he goes, and another characteristic of the space is you are going to say yes.
Well, I'm reminded of, I read about this, I wasn't there for that, that EJ, when they were doing their childbirth service, he would on occasion ask the woman, are you sure you want to do this?
Yeah.
So that's so.
It sounds funny, but it's the opportunity to reaffirm.
That's the reason.
Okay.
You know, it's the jokingness is it gives it a little bit more light energy, which in that space is very useful.
Yeah.
Most women appreciate it, but it also is like, okay, you want to do this.
That's the point.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's like a gift to have somebody give you that opportunity to reconfirm.
I'd like to read this before we go too far. Bernie LaPlante says, if we agree that new organs come into being by necessity, how do you increase that necessity without the classic transactional movement of wanting something in exchange?
That's a core question.
Can it be that we stop demanding, recollecting esteem, power, knowledge, comfort, but instead renounce and start giving without reserve?
So I'm going to go way out on a limb here for it to answer him. And it's because for the first time, we might be able to live a life that isn't saying, what do I get out of this? I'm going to do this because I want to do it. And here's the scary part. Can you turn to that kernel of necessity within you and say, what is it that you would like?
Mm-hmm.
And then we are on the altar of sacrifice at that point.
But I have to jump in here and say that you are talking about the antidote or the contrast or the other than this list of EJs here, which is desire, considering, habit, or inherited beliefs, because those things there are going to either remove you or make a barrier to anything like this work or essence life.
Telling us fundamentally, this is not transactional. I'll give you this and you give me that. This is non-transactional interaction with the universe. And we've got to do the joyous sacrifice at some point again. It's just too critical to what we're talking about. There's a form of high sacrifice that you make. It's active surrender. The terminology I've been using is you're actively surrendering. And you think, well, that doesn't make sense. But that's the only way to do it well.
Now, just to keep this in the how do we work with this material on a daily basis commentary, the use of the term idiot,
yeah,
there are sources of information about the, how many, 18 idiots, am I correct?
It varies depending on.
I know, but we have something. We had a number of idiots, but the reference to idiotness is very helpful if you start with the simplest form, which in my opinion is when you get up first thing in the morning and you say, "Hey, what does this idiot want for breakfast?" So you have a way of distancing yourself immediately from that which is, gotta have that, give me some, whatever the thing is that's running already. Just cut it a little bit of humor. and then do a little research about what is an idiot and how is it used in this terminology as a way to give yourself access to what he's saying, a voluntary slave, we could say, idiot.
Yeah, I think that's good. I like what Pat's saying a lot, and I think that we also should, it's worth looking into what that an actual practice of Gurdjieff's, which was called toasting the idiots.
Go ahead.
Eric Brummel says, it takes a lot, it seems, to let the higher self actually direct the machine. It was a lot of years to see that the higher self will place the machine in harm's way at times to direct the machine's path.
So this is starting to just uncover a different viewpoint once again. But acknowledge what's going on in you. Acknowledge in your own heart that some of these, this force, this sensation, this desire is within you.
Mm-hmm.
Just acknowledge it and try to visit it every once in a while and let it come out a little bit. How's that? How are we doing here? Good start.
That was chapter 34. What was that?
We'll do 37 next time. You there, Harry?
I am.
Good.
Excellent. Great comment tonight.
Vigorous interchange.
This feels like one of those talks where you close the book or you walk out of the living room or whatever it is, and you say like, boy, I wish that could have lasted another week or two. Why would I ever want to leave that space?
But thank you for coming, and we look forward to seeing you next week at 7 o'clock. Good night.
Good night.